Hello everyone and welcome back to the Esports Roundtable podcast, where we discuss the past, present and future of all things business and esports. Last week we were joined by Mark Garvey Candela from Twitch, and we were talking all about the Twitch initiatives around everything to do with collegiate esports on a global basis. This week we are joined by Kelby May, the director of team sponsorship strategy and fulfillment for Twitch, who is more notably known by the public community when he was the GM for CLG back in the day. I was also spent a good few years with Good Game as their VP of accounts and talent. For this episode, we're going to be focusing in on analyzing Twitch's position in the market as one of the only true mediators, which works with all of the teams, all of the publishers, and all of the tournament organizers across every title, as well as exploring the landscape of esports team sponsorship and how this is likely to change with all of the franchise organizations getting off the ground in early 2018. Kelby, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Yeah, Joe, thanks for having me.
Awesome. So before we get started into the details, it'll be great just to hear your story, how you got into esports and how you got to where you are today.
Okay, cool. Do you want the long version or the condensed version?
Let's try to find something relatively in between. I don't
know. Okay, sure. So, been a big gamer my whole life. Was also into traditional sports very heavily when I was in college, or high school rather. And then when I went to college, focused more on academics, couldn't play traditional sports anymore. So I found actually MLG from a neighbor in my dorm freshman year.
Cool.
I was a big Halo guy. Introduced me into, you know, essentially what professional gaming is. It took off from there. Esports kind of replaced my competitive edge that I had in college that I traditionally found through traditional sports. And then found League at the end of my senior college year. Had played Halo competitively for a bit, nothing like where I was like a pro player or anything, but just took the game really seriously while I was in college. I had an econ degree, so I got a general banking job after I graduated. Hated it, and you know, more often than not, it's about what you know, who you know, not what you know.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
I had a friend whose dad became the president of the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences that does the Dice Summit. They're like very akin to the Motion Picture Academy except for the game industry.
Okay.
He was looking for, you know, somebody to come intern for them. I went down, interned for them, busted my butt. He offered me a job, moved from Seattle where I'd been living to California, did that for a couple years, and then on the side started volunteering for CLG as a writer for their website. Did a series called This Week in Esports back in like 2010. George Hotshot GG saw the series on the site, liked it, inquired more about me, made me tournament director for some of the like community tournaments that they were running. Like that, CLG started looking for a team house in California where I was living, asked me to help them find it, asked me to move in, help manage the team. All that went great and eventually led to him asking me to leave my job, kind of help him run the company full time. Did that for a couple years and, you know, kind of just ran from there.
Awesome.
Where I ran CLG for a couple years and then went to join Alex and Colin at Good Game and Evil Geniuses and Alliance. And then we got bought by Twitch and now I'm doing sponsorship sales at Twitch.
Awesome. It's been one of the things that I've been slightly confused about my own personal journey in gaming as well. Like when I was supposedly focusing the most on my future with regards to being at university, it was probably the time that I was most involved in the highest level of competitive play that I've got to, which arguably
right.
wasn't that high, but it's just because you have so much control over your day that you can really choose to do with it what you want.
I personally found university to give me a lot more free time and be a lot easier academically than high school was. So, yeah, I could spend a ton of time just gaming in college.
Yeah, and it's cool to see someone else that's kind of built themselves off the writing side too. That was one of that's one of the kind of easier ways to start marketing yourself and demonstrating that you've actually got some industry knowledge. That's what I was doing with the Esports Observer when I first started with Norman Broadbent as well. So good job on you. There's lots of interesting content that you've been involved with over the course of the last few years. I know that you were on Travis's show recently, Hotline League, speaking with a few people from Team Liquid and just kind of casting your hat in on the league scene, who's moving where. From a team perspective across League and Overwatch, who do you think has won the first battle on the brand side and on the talent side for the strongest pickups or for the best kind of repositioning of their brand for 2018?
Yeah, for sure. On the Overwatch side, as it relates to talent, I'm not as familiar, though from everybody that I've talked to, it seems like C9 and obviously the Korean team. I think it's Dynasty, right?
Yeah.
They have the strongest rosters because they're the best Korean squads.
Yeah.
I'm personally, actually let me answer the branding part of it first and then I'll take a tangent on talent talks. I really like Outlaws branding a lot. I think Optic has always been really strong in how they handle their brand regardless. A lot of the Overwatch brands feel very generic to me in general, uninspiring, I would personally say, but I mean, that's just my subjective taste. But Outlaws, you know, like I liked what they did and, I felt like, you know, it was one of the more creative ones, especially their usage and the different elements in the logo.
Yeah.
On the talent side, though, I do worry about what Overwatch League will look like in regards to makeup of talent and what regions they're from, because I think that there's probably going to be, with only, you know, 12 teams in the league at this point, I'm worried that every roster essentially will be filled up with predominantly Korean squads, and I'm worried that it'll end up like StarCraft II did, where essentially, at the top level of competition, all we're looking at is Korean players across every single region. And it feels really weird to me that right now we've got 9 North American teams, 1 in Europe, 1 in China, 1 in South Korea, and all of these squads, all these teams are going to be predominantly Korean. And, like, it just, I don't think it's going to, that concerns me from a viewership perspective about how fans get engaged, involved, and care, because...
Yeah. Why would people rally around the local flag of their organization being in their city if they don't necessarily identify with any of the players? I mean, the language barrier is a massive inescapable object when it comes to marketing in the West for Asia-Pac talent, so I'm 100% with you there.
And Korean players tend to stream less, a lot like European players, and I've always personally had the major belief that streaming helps dictate viewership and fan engagement and your attachment to players on a huge level, because streaming, when you're sat there in front of the camera for hours at a time, just your raw personality exposed, is the best way for somebody to kind of get a feel for who you are as a person and grow like an attachment to you and your personality. It seems perplexing to me because Blizzard already went through this whole like learning, I thought, as we understood in StarCraft, where they announced WCS and immediately from the start, like there were a lot of us, myself and Katz, most notably, who were really outspoken about our concerns for the way that they had handled region locking and how it would affect the league. And we saw, I think it was 46 or 36 out of 38 players at WCS Global Finals the first 3 years be Korean and only 2 be foreigner. And like it just, man, it impacts investment for other regions so much. Like, when all you're seeing is just like Korean players dominating everything. Some people want to see just the best games, and then that's totally fine. I'm personally one of those people where I never minded that Korea dominated WCS or LCK or anything, but the rest have to follow, and I don't want to see the same thing for Overwatch, and I wonder what the thinking is internally at Blizzard, where they think that this will be different than what StarCraft II was.
Yeah, it's really important from my perspective that, you know, the future of the industry is really around the narrative of the teams and building those storylines. And if the North American market is where most of the investment is actually happening, and then you have a massive disconnect between the kind of talent that's actually playing, that can't be good long term. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that we can do from an esports culture perspective to elevate Western play to actually rival that? Or is this always going to be like an inescapable obstacle just because of the way that Korean players actually approach the game?
Man, it's such a good question. it's such a good question, and it's something where I've always had the belief, and I haven't seen evidence to the contrary, that any title that Korea cares about, they will be dominant in, because that's just what we've seen historically up until this point. I think that it starts at the ground level, as you've identified, where culturally, for whatever reason, they're just so much more serious about everything. And I think that it's not that in the professional scenes that North American or European talent is not serious. But I feel like, for whatever reason, Korean squads are able to more easily avoid burnout and fatigue, especially in like an LCS season. Or at least I don't get that same feeling that they experience it as heavily as North American and EU talent does. And also, it's more closely tied to the roots than that, because still to this day, I hear from professional league players that Korean solo queue is just a world different than North American and European solo queue in regards to like how seriously they take the game, and like everybody's tryharding, and just the the most core basic experience that you have is matchmaking for a game, right? That's how talent is developed for like 90% of their careers in every region. It's like the overwhelming majority of the games that you will play in your life is through matchmaking. And because their systems are so much more serious and they're way more tryhard and thinking about strategy way more, it's just like ingrained into their solo queue culture, it develops better talent and better players. So until we see some sort of cultural paradigm shift, and I don't know what instigates it, in North American EU, I don't expect that we will contend with Korea. It's kind of similar to a lot of things that we see in traditional sports, where regionally, certain parts of the world excel for whatever reason in different sports. Maybe not necessarily for the same reasons, but like, you know, South America and Dominican and Caribbean are incredibly good at baseball. Canada owns at hockey. I don't know what it takes in order for the West to catch up to Korea. But honestly, I think that if anybody does it, it's probably China.
Yeah, one of my thoughts, just from being a fan for much longer than I've been working in the space, is seeing how humble Eastern players seem to be versus the almost out of control egos of a lot of Western players.
Mm-hmm.
I'll use Doublelift as an example from the Worlds. I saw there's a lot of hype moving into that tournament. Perhaps this is just his persona as a streamer rather than as a player too, but seemed like not taking a lot of the competition very seriously. The results weren't ideal. And then after Worlds, seemingly quite quickly, the ego was completely back to where it was, because maybe the quality of the local solo queue, like you were saying, isn't high enough to really be challenging. I've seen that kind of run away with people, not just in esports, but in many other walks of life. You know, you get a taste of success and a recognition for what you've done, and then you start to believe in your own hype, and that ultimately spells your demise. You know, I'm a massive mixed martial arts fan, and the amount of times I've seen someone believe that they're indestructible and then lose to someone that they really shouldn't have, because that person was 100% focused, had been only thinking about taking everything that the person across the ring had from them and using it just to kind of further their life. It's happened so many times. And I wonder whether that's a kind of, not a sleeping giant in the West of esports, but if there is something that can really be done to manage that and make people take play more seriously. You know, I thought that maybe with a lot more of the sports psychologists and the structures around the teams themselves, that this would improve. Mm-hmm. But it seems to be one of the things that I see happen, not just in League, but in Counter-Strike as well.
Yeah. I personally feel that there's not a effort or lack of respect issue in League in particular with professional NA and EU teams, especially at the top level. Okay. I think that a lot of what you probably see in regards to guys projecting confidence is just that, because it's very, very important for professional players to, when they get on main stage, feel really, really good about where they are, so you're playing to win and not to lose. That's one thing that Peter and I actually talked about after Worlds, is that part of the reason that he thinks that EU continues to find more success than NA on the world stage is not necessarily a disparity in talent level or anything like that, but EU has this ability, for whatever reason, to play like with no fear on the big stage, and it eludes North American teams apparently, and I don't know what fixes that or changes it, but I certainly think that probably people projecting confidence and, you know, coming out and doing that is trying to reinforce that, not only publicly, but mentally to themselves.
Sure.
Like, you know, like, we are going to do it. We're going to be successful. You need to believe you're going to win if you're actually going to have a chance to win on the stage.
Yeah, I completely get that. And I do feel that there's a thin line between doing that enough to kind of amp yourself up and then maybe taking it too far. You work a lot closer with the players than I do, so I'll take your thoughts as being more accurate than my kind of fan-related dreamings. But it is a very interesting aspect of the space, performance optimization and helping these young superstars that get thrust into the limelight so quickly be able to maximize their time there. It's been something that we've focused on with the podcast before, kind of speaking about what lies past being in the spotlight for pros as kind of business opportunities, or what else can people actually do rather than just stream. So it's an interesting point that I hope that we'll see some more improvement on in the future. Let's take a step back from speaking about the talent for a second, and let's analyze the space from a macro perspective. Esports is exceptionally fractured and between unique fans within unique gaming titles. Each ecosystem is run in a very different way. The very obvious point is Valve versus Riot, or Valve versus Blizzard. Twitch sits at a really interesting position in the space, is working with pretty much everyone. From your experience kind of being in New York for the last few years, how do you feel that Twitch has done as in promoting, I guess the way to phrase it would be promoting the good of the industry for all of those that are involved, from the players, from the teams, from the fans, from publishers, from the tournament organizers, and where do you see their role in the future?
Well, I think obviously Twitch and every other platform that has existed along the way plays probably the most crucial role in making esports exist up to this point, because, I mean, without the advent of live streaming and the furtherment of ISP technology and bandwidth ability, like, we wouldn't have it as it exists, essentially. I think that they've done a really good job. I'm biased. I work for Twitch. but I think that they've done a really good job playing, you know, like mediator in Switzerland, essentially, between all these different parties that, you know, like are sometimes, you know, in competition against each other. I don't think Twitch, you know, is like showing favoritism to teams versus tournament organizers versus individual content creators. And I think that it's really important that it continues not to do that. I mean, it's essentially the thing that I really like about Twitch is it's an equal opportunity platform, essentially, as I view it, for anybody that wants to come on and create content and try and reach an audience in this space. I do think, however, that competition is good for the industry. As somebody, you know, with an econ degree, I believe that the more competition we have in a market is, you know, what's going to drive people to have better advancements in technology, create a better product for the consumer, and ultimately push the industry forward. I think for the overwhelming majority of essentially, since live streaming became a thing in 2010, we really only had a couple years, or maybe even like a year and a half at the start, where OWND and Twitch were in serious competition before OWND went under.
Yeah.
And other than that, the space has just been completely dominated by one platform or another. At the start, it was actually OWND, and then Twitch and OWND were in competition, essentially, when TSM went to Twitch for a period of time before OWND went under. And then OWND went under, and since then, Twitch has owned the space. No pun intended. I think that I really haven't seen what I wanted to see, or might have even been afraid to see at times, from YouTube Gaming or Facebook. I personally think that as the market space exists right now, YouTube Gaming has the most opportunity to make advancements in the market and get better market share, because their video player is really good. But chat and discoverability on YouTube Gaming Live is far from, you know, probably what the average person likes so much about Twitch, and also your ability to monetize on the platform, as particularly as an individual broadcaster, doesn't seem to be as strong. Facebook, I think, has this really, really heavy uphill challenge, not just with live streaming, but with our demographic in general, where social platforms, in my perception, do this thing where they're undiscovered or pretty much only known by this niche group of younger people. MySpace started that way. Facebook started that way. And then they hit a saturation level in the mass market where once your parents are on Facebook, essentially, like, it becomes uncool. And now, like, personally, I know, like, way more people over the age of 40 using Facebook regularly than people under the age of 40. Whereas now, you know, like, everybody is shifting towards Twitter and Instagram and Snapchat and these other social platforms where you don't see, like, a lot of your parents on, right? Because, you know, it's not cool to be on the same social platform as your mom and dad.
That's actually a really smart point that I haven't really realized, but it just kind of naturally everyone's moved over that way. It makes sense.
Yeah, anecdotally, and based on what I see from, you know, like analytics on team activities and stuff like that, Facebook is not a super attractive platform for our audience. And not only that, but like, discoverability in regards to like the feed and the video player and how you engage and monetization, like they're way further behind everybody else. And I don't, like, Facebook is such a big company that is so much more invested in these other things. I don't know that live streaming becomes a priority for them as quickly as it does for YouTube, which is much more intrinsically tied to it as a video and content delivery platform. And obviously Twitch, who is just live streaming. But the other thing too is that, like, now that Twitch is owned by Amazon, it's one of those things where, like, if I'm on the outside looking in and I'm like, oh man, live streaming is this big thing, I want to take a piece of the pie. Starting a live streaming platform has such an incredible barrier to entry from a cost perspective. And not only that, but it's really kind of a naturally feast or famine market where I personally don't believe that pulling away, like, big tournaments, for example, isn't a way to attract viewership to your platform. Like, Azubu tried it a little bit back in the day. YouTube Gaming Live has tried it a couple times where, like, you take over these big tournaments and you can pull, like, viewership. You can essentially buy viewership to some degree around these big events, but ultimately what I think you want to do is attract people coming to your platform on a regular basis because they want to watch
so much content. Upfront cost to even trying to get a few people to move over to your platform, like in the first place. So it makes a lot of sense. I mean, we've been kind of looking at the streaming market for when we take the podcast live, and initially we thought Facebook Live would be where it's at, but to be honest, YouTube has the most gaming content around, and Twitch is an obvious place that we have to be. So it's an interesting market. Like, I understand why the likes of Twitter and Facebook have obviously had to put these functions out there. But it's just going to be interesting to see how that settles from an esports perspective. I'm quite cognizant that we're running out of time, so I just want to touch on one or two bits and bobs. Mm-hmm. Your day-to-day is very much focused on representing the teams from a commercial standpoint. As we've already touched on slightly with the players, the landscape of esports is really going to be changing across the tier one titles with franchising actually getting started. We're having big non-endemic sporting and entertainment bodies that are stepping in with their seasoned back office staff, their larger budgets, and kind of just more well-versed business teams. How do you feel like the landscape of sponsorship and how teams actually monetize is going to change over the next, say, 24 months?
You know, it's an interesting question because I think that, honestly, right now, there's a lot of responsibility that falls to these organizations that have received franchise slots. What I am interested in as a viewer and also as somebody who works with advertisers is now that you have secured all of this backing and you have secured a permanent spot in this franchise system, how does what you're doing around your team, whether it be talent, infrastructure, content creation, change and get leveled up to provide more value to me, the fan, and in turn to potential advertisers? Because I don't think that just because people have a franchise spot, it now instantly becomes so much more appealing for a non-endemic or blue chip or somebody with a large amount of budget to come into the space and be like, oh, now esports is where I want to be. Like, first off, these companies are only going to work with tier one brands, as long as they're not horribly misguided. And before, you weren't worried about whether TSM or C9 or most years TL were going to be in the LCS, or whether they would have a good squad, or whether they were going to do the content that they already do. That was a given, and I don't think that's not really been a big hurdle for me ever in having conversations with brands about their investment in the space, especially non-endemic ones, because they don't even really know enough to know that, like, the people could even lose this slot. Really, what we need to see now in regards to attracting bigger budgets from people already involved in the space and attracting new brands into the space is, with all this money and stability, what are you going to provide to me, the fan, and to me, the advertiser, that creates more value where budgets can increase? That said, there's also something to be said for the fact that once franchising gets put into place, it adds a certain level of legitimacy to the space, and as every single year goes on, it becomes something where a lot of people are like, man, this esports thing is big, and it's cool, and it's hitting the demo we want, but is it just like a flash in the pan? Do I want to put a bunch of money in this and then, like, I don't know, kids, it's a fad, you know? Like, kids will move on to the next thing, and then I've invested in this thing that isn't existing. Franchising kind of works against that notion and makes people feel more good about their potential, especially long-term investment, into organizations and creating a relationship with a brand, especially when people are asking to be treated in a similar manner as, you know, traditional sports franchises are. Not necessarily, like, you know, premier level, but maybe, like, yeah, MLS level or NHL level in regards to, you know, how seriously we're taking, you know, the approach to the space and what we're asking from brands and stuff. But ultimately, I think that, yeah, this is now the time where teams don't just say, oh, hey, I have franchising, where's my money? You take the money that you've gotten from this outside investment, and you take your security in the spot, and this is your new opportunity to innovate. And new opportunity to do new and bigger and better things, to show more value, and essentially prove to us why you received this franchise spot. And the people that do that will, I think, succeed, obviously, tremendously, not only from being able to attract more money into the space, into their organization, but fans that
come with
it. Yeah,
that's pretty smart, actually. I mean, as people that are going to work specifically like in this ecosystem, in the esports bubble, franchising is absolutely massive overnight, but obviously doesn't change the perspective of a Diageo or a Coke who might be looking at the space.
Right.
So that's very, very smart. Haven't actually...
Is LCS going to get more views because teams are franchised?
It's what they do with it, right? Yeah.
So
it's smart. It's smart. Yeah. And I think if you look at, if we just go back to which teams are doing really well on that side, who've already started producing awesome content, who are winning the Reddit war, I think Team Liquid and the Houston Outlaws are absolutely destroying it. Been really on the spot with putting out stuff on the day or just before all of these major announcements, being super clear, lots of effort, speaking the fans' language. It's really smart. So I'm super excited to see how this all changes and who steps up to the plate in the next few months. It's been awesome to have you on. Really looking forward to staying in touch in the future and seeing where we can bring you back on the show as the space changes. But just before we let you go, got one more question for you. We have our recurring segment every single week where we ask our guests the same question. And today, our question is called The Edge of Time. So, Kelby, if you could have any pro-facing role in esports, in any esports title, past, present, fantasy, or future, what would it be and why? We've had people say mascots. We've had people say, I want to be the analyst for the Football Manager esports series. We've had some pretty wacky stuff. We've had some very political answers. Where do you see yourself in this wonderful world of basically whatever you want it to be?
Sure. My answer is probably not overly sexy, but it's very honest.
Okay.
When I was in junior high, I wanted to be an agent, you know, like essentially like a Jerry Maguire thing for traditional sports. Probably the best experience of my career to date is the relationship that I built with Doublelift Peter, who's one of my best friends. And, you know, we lived together for 2 years, and there was building the relationship with him and also being able to work with him on his brand and how he was approaching, you know, how he was thinking about the space. His work ethic, his attitude about what he wanted to get out of his pro gaming career, and kind of seeing him develop, mature, and evolve as a dude over time was really gratifying for me. I really want to work with star players who want to make the most out of their time and are looking for coaching and development on how they can be their best selves and not only make the most out of their pro gaming career, but also set themselves up for actually having a career and transitioning after pro play. Because as we've seen, most people are only able to do it until like their mid-20s. Yeah. So in summary, the professional role that appeals most to me in the space is the role that I think I will definitely eventually end up in, which is talent representation.
That's a fantastic answer. And I think that the more people that we have in the space that are seeking to put their focus into the pro players and maximizing their time in the spotlight, which is something that we've already covered multiple times on this episode, and I've mentioned and been harping on about over and over and over again, just trying to pick everyone's brain to see what their approach is to kind of helping these kids really make the most of it. The more people that we have with that mindset and making those really strong impacts is just going to elevate the quality of the entire industry. So definitely on the same page with you for that. That's all we've got time for this episode. So I just want to thank yourself for coming on the show. If people want to reach out to you, if they want to send any feedback, if they want to drop you a line, what's the best way for them to get in touch?
Twitter handle is @KelbyMay, and you can always email me, kelby@twitch.tv.
Awesome. Well, guys, thank you very much for tuning into the show. If you want to reach out to us, as always, my Twitter handle is @BarelyQualified, BarelyQualified. It's nice and easy for you. It'll be in the description of the episode, or if you want to reach out to us on Facebook, it's LFG Esports HR. We're going to be changing everything when it comes to social media, so please do stay tuned for next year when we're going to be really hitting this hard. The quality of the guests that we've had so far this year, yourself included, sir, has been absolutely fantastic. I'm so excited to see where we can take this next year. Kelby, thank you for coming on the show.
Yeah, Joe, thanks so much for having me, dude.
Everyone else, we'll speak to you soon. Ciao.